Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Amitabha Kumar's latest, My Beloved Life, is a moving novel that traces the arc of a man's life, an ordinary life made exceptional by the fact that he has loved and has been loved in turn. We meet Jadu Kunwar, whose life skates between the mythical and the mundane, and as changes big and small sweep across India, finds meaning in the most unexpected places. He befriends poets and politicians. He becomes a historian. And he has a daughter, a television journalist with a career in the United States, whose own story recasts the past in a new light. Amitabha Kumar explores how we tell stories and write history, how individuals play a counterpoint to big movements, how no single life is without consequence. He's the author of the novels Immigrant Montana and A Time Outside This Time, as well as several other books of nonfiction and fiction. The latest is My Beloved Life, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Amitabha Kumar to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing so well. Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I always enjoy our conversations. The book is beautiful. It's very different, at least in the beginning, it is very different from your previous novel. Yes. And I'm interested of what brought you to want to, especially in the first half, to give us this history lesson of not only this man, but of India in general.
Yeah. You know, I was traveling on Metro North. I'm talking about something that was maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago. And I was reading Dennis Johnson's short novella, Train Dreams.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a story about an ordinary man, someone who works as a timber worker in Idaho at the beginning of the last century. And by the time we come to the end and his death, in such a slim novel, it felt like an introduction to a whole century. And maybe it had an epic feel to it. And I began thinking, what if instead of Idaho, we were in India? And how could an ordinary life, not an extraordinary life, not a life of a leader, not someone who has had a great role to play in history, but someone who is small, how in telling that story, I could actually also be telling the story of a nation, maybe, and even of a century. So that's what brought me to it.
And there seems to be this man, this ordinary man, does have a, I know this has been said in reviews, but I thought of it too as I was reading it, that there is a Zelig-like quality to, he seems to be at all the right places at all the right times in the sense, but I guess you could say that about all of us because we live through these things and we have a certain degree of separation and non-separation from those huge happenings in our world.
Yes. Didn't 9/11 happen to each one of us?
Right.
And yet, how different is the quality of witnessing or our engagement or our suffering from it? More importantly, how to value any one person's witnessing or suffering from that one event? So, you know, in case of Dennis Johnson, whom I cited as my model, there was, you know, that ordinary timber worker is standing beside a railroad line and the train stops. And what he describes as a young hillbilly singer comes out, and that's Elvis Presley. And I began thinking, well, suppose someone was like my father, born in that year, 1935, who would he have seen? And I didn't want to go for someone like Gandhi or someone like that, but instead I thought, oh, he's a young man. What if he meets the man who first climbed Everest with Edmund Hillary, a Sherpa, you know? And so that's how I thought of, you know, inventing a scene like that, yeah.
And even a proximity to George Orwell.
Yes. You know, George Orwell, as some of your readers might know, was the son of an opium sub-agent working for the British. And he was born in a small town, which is actually just 40 minutes from my own ancestral village. And my father actually taught in that town. So I thought, yeah, let's make that connection. You know, we live lives rich in connections to things between places and between people, all of us.
There is a the way the book is sectioned. We read initially the good first half of the book is of this man's life and growing yes. up, and then we we move forward a bit to that of his daughter. Were they informed by one another? Were they written very differently and separately in the sense of both by time and even by idea?
Yes, they were. You know, there is a great line of John Burgess, the British writer, whose line was, "Never again will a story be told as though it were the only one." And it has been used by Michael Ondaatje, Arundhati Roy, even Kiran Desai in their books in order to establish that beside any one dominant story, there is another one that is more marginal or less noticed. And so I was had it at the back of my mind, but I just wanted to tell the story of the man first. And that's how I did it. And then I began thinking of that other dictum. And then I thought, okay, what story can I put next to it that would make us experience storytelling and differences, let's say of generations, of gender, of identities, a little differently? And then came up the idea of telling the daughter's life. And I also wanted to come closer to America, you know? So I had her come to America.
Yeah, put her on a plane, and also to Atlanta at CNN, where she works as a journalist. The idea of having her as a journalist allows her that opportunity to be up close to what is happening in the world.
Yes, to be a witness. That has always been a great, that idea has always held a great aesthetic appeal to me, you know, how to make the reader an alert observer, so that they are taking in the world, they are processing it and putting it into words in some way.
The reason I asked the question 2 questions ago about the timing and the separation is because I assume that the first part of this was very much underway as the pandemic comes in, because then in the second part, when we're reading about the daughter, the pandemic does play a very large role.
Yeah. Well, to be very honest, I was writing also a little bit out of my fear, you know. When the pandemic arrived, my father was in his late 80s, and I was afraid he would die because vaccines were not available. He lived in a small town in India. And so I think I was approaching that fear in casting it in that time zone and thinking about that. And my father did die, but he did not die of COVID. He died more recently. And I was thinking about my grief, what would happen. And I had the daughter imagine that. And I have to tell you, Joe, that when my father did die last March, it seemed as if there were pages from my own novel coming in somewhere true in the ICU, because, you know, he was on a ventilator too, and the difficulty of breathing, what I was feeling and what I was thinking of seemed to bring my novel to life or make it true, because my character had also seen an electric bulb for the first time when he was 10 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but even the details of the death and etc. just seemed to bring, and I mentioned this, you know, it just seemed to bring that novel closer to me. And I mentioned this in order to say that never have I had a more clearer proof for myself in my practice of the intimacy between life and literature.
It's fascinating to me that you say that, because I felt that as I was reading it, that you were coming from a place of grief and loss.
Oh, yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah. And, you know, there are other deaths.
Rumination.
And also, yes. You know, I don't think the pandemic has ended, of course, in the same way as I don't think 9/11 has ended.
Right.
The long shadow of the fallen towers, you know, lies over all of us. And that way, the pandemic will continue in some ways. And novels have yet not been written to take stock of the consequences of that. And so the lingering grief comes a little bit out of that, I think.
Amitava Kumar is our guest. The new novel is My Beloved Life, and it's published by Knopf. Was it always your intention to have a daughter rather than a son? The father-daughter relationship obviously is very different than the father-son relationship. And I mean, there's certainly universal aspects to it, but it is a very different relationship.
Yes. There are two things. One, you're quite right. I was thinking of my sisters, and I was thinking, did my father, who loved his daughters, obviously, but did he have a real sense of how different their lives were from his? So I did want to go there. The other point I want to tell you is, we have talked about my previous novels, and people, maybe because I would plant little clues like maybe the narrator is, living in Hudson Valley, he's a professor at a liberal arts college. People always thought that I was only reporting from life and not inventing anything. There was no
Right.
space for imagination. And so I was very consciously going in this book to create different characters, who would not so easily be mistaken for just me reporting from life unimaginatively.
Fair. Well, with that said,
Yes.
the daughter is still a journalist,
Yes, yes, yes.
as you are, and
Yes.
a writer, and also is I assume one of the universal aspects of that relationship is the very difficult prospect of maintaining a close relationship with someone who's half a world away.
Yes. We are living increasingly in a global world where our families or parts of our families occupy different land masses separated by large bodies of water. When will a call come that will summon you to a deathbed, for example? How to catch a plane, and what are your thoughts on the plane? These things have been, great preoccupations of mine for a long time, and it is, as you rightly say, it is universal. I mean, there's a poem by Sharon Olds, for example, that talks about her getting a call and the doctor saying that your father will not last the night, and she rushes to the airport and the flight is about to leave. Then someone says, there is another plane, and she rushes there. And then she poem ends by her saying, and I arrived and watched his chest rise and fall through the night. I'm sure all these anxieties, these worries are, in the hearts of people who think about their
Sure.
loved ones in other places.
The book has such a rapid pace to it. There's a very there's a lot here, and there's a lot of stories. And I just want to ask, and I realize in asking the question, it may sound like a criticism, and it's far from it. So I just want to preface this by this, but there's a part toward the end of the novel. Where the daughter is having a very long conversation with another woman about her life. And it is a back and forth. And you give that meeting, you give that meeting with a stranger a lot of room. And I'm interested in what that meant to you in the sense of how that fits in to get that conversation and what ultimately it provides us in the overall story of these lives.
Wonderful. Yeah. Let me explain. As you rightly say, she gets a lot of space, that woman who is a doctor.
Yes.
And my interest was, how can a story towards the end encapsulate much of what has gone before in terms of telling the story of the transformation of a land? And there I was faced with the question, how does fascism of a kind, how does intolerance arrive in a small town? And that's the essence for me, the emotional heart of what that woman is telling. And it happens over decades, her story. So I thought that precisely if a lot has happened before, how to slow it down through a single person's long drawn out account, which would nevertheless encapsulate or repeat even what has happened before. So once again, never again will a story be told as though it were the only one. We get another story, this one, the doctor's story, but it has its own individuality. It has its own pace. And I thought that if I gave her, it is not a back and forth in the sense of a rapid fire exchange. The doctor gets
No.
to very calmly, as she sips her tea, green tea, and one jalapeno margarita. She recounts the story. And so that was the purpose of it. And then I wanted, after that story was over, to have these other quick sections, including the arrival of a surprising testimony from a character we have not met before.
That is the ending in which I don't want to give away, but
Yeah.
that is, did you know that that was coming from the very beginning?
No. That happened during a leisurely walk in the ecological preserve at Vassar College. I was walking along. I always carry a little notebook and a small golf pencil. And I remember the moment I was crossing a little swampy bit of land, and I was watching a bird settling, just descending on a pond. And this idea just, I don't know from where it came, but there it was. I wrote it down and I said, and I came back home and I typed it out.
And it's, to me, that's bold because you're ending your novel. I mean, that's how you end. That's what you leave us with. And that is when it works, as in this case, it obviously does. But if it doesn't, it can upend the whole preceding 300 pages.
Yes, and Joe, you're a careful reader, but I have to tell you, an editor, not here, but in another country, sent back a note very quickly and said, "Who's this person?" That person, that editor had not made the connection, and I thought, "Oh my God!" So you're right. It felt to me like a risk, but no one else has raised that point, so I'm hoping that it will work.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love it because it just comes out of the blue, and that's a lovely thing to happen, especially at the end of a novel. I also
Thank
respect novels that actually have endings.
you. Yes.
Amitabha Kumar is our guest. The name of the new book is My Beloved Wife. I just quickly want to say that I read this book when it was in galley, and then I to prepare, I listened to you read it in the audio version.
Oh,
And
wow.
you reading this book is such a special treat. And again, I will say, even you were talking earlier about that separation of wanting to separate of people making the connection. And it is harder not to make the connection when I'm hearing you tell the story,
Yes, I
obviously.
see it. I see it now. Yes.
But first of all, you have the most amazing diction I have ever. It is beautiful,
Thank
beautiful
you.
diction. I,
Oh,
as a
God.
broadcaster, I aspire to have that
Oh, man, you're legendary. Come on. But yes, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate
beautiful
it.
diction. But I think that in the telling of it, I assume there is a point where a decision is made of who's going to read it, and that you say, which I think you did with your last book too. Am I right?
Yes, I
Yes.
did. I did. Yes, you're right.
Is that you are comfortable with that? That there is that something that you feel is important in for an author to tell the story, both in print version but also in an audio form.
In my case, it is. I don't think it holds true for everyone. For those folks who like Audible, for example, or listening to books on tape, for example, I'll recommend the reading of the George Eliot novel, Middlemarch.
Right.
Is read by this wonderful actress, this actress from Great Britain. She is marvelous, amazing. In my case, out of, how shall I say, good intentions, editors, producers will sometimes ask people of Indian origin to read it. But these are folks who do not have my history, do not have those roots. They have been born here often, and they get some things very wrong. And I just wanted. So for me, it's just a desire to claim my roots in some ways that makes me want to read. And at some places, it will sound like a boast, but when I'm reading those words, it seems like I'm pouring my essence into it. It's like
Sure.
something is coming true or alive. And so it felt like a good experience doing
Do
it
you
again.
ever look at it and say, "Oh, in telling it, I maybe this should be changed"?
Yes. In fact, a couple of times I had the producer in the studio make a note that I don't like that sentence. I would like to change it. So I did. I did. I did. Yes.
What you were saying, I thought was interesting. If I'm reading you correctly, when you were talking about reading the book, that you are comfortable with it because there are certain parts of it that you don't want someone else. It's your language. You want it to sound right. You want it to sound the way you intended it. There are parts that are phrasing, obviously. and names and so forth
Yes.
that you want pronounced correctly. And I'm just asking, so you have the power in reading that to make it right, to make it exactly the way that you want it to be. How worried are you that we, let's say an American reader like me, a middle-aged white guy, Amitabha, that I will read this and still be able to get that?
Yes, yes. One thing that I always think about is when Chekhov was writing, and I'm saying I'm Chekhov, but I'm saying when Chekhov was writing, he did not ever think, how will this play in Peoria, you know? Will someone be able to pronounce the name of this particular character or something? No, and neither did he worry about the emotions. He wanted to be authentic to his own experience and the experience of the people around him. And that's the same with me. That's the same with me. I do not think that a person on 42nd Street in New York listening to me will feel especially estranged. No, they are dealing with an exotic place maybe sometimes, or people with a different name or a different accent. But I have a fundamental belief in our common shared humanity. This little vanity thing that I have about the names, it's not even about getting it right. It's almost as if I want to say, I want to get it wrong in the most authentic way. You know, in other words, I know that I do. My wife continues to tell me how I pronounce the word development or precedent wrong, you know? And that's cool. But I know that I pronounce it in the way that 1 billion and 25 billion people in the Indian subcontinent pronounce it. So I feel that's authentic anyway. You know, I'm comfortable
that's right.
with it. That's
yes.
So what all I'm saying is, I try to make it, I think one of the goals of writing today is that many of us lead translated lives. You know, we are displaced in different ways. Or you might be a middle-aged white guy, but you step into a restaurant where you're ordering bulgogi, or you're ordering, you know, chow mein, you know, and we inhabit these other various selves. And I think there shouldn't be discomfort about it. There should only be the excitement of discovery and shared pleasures.
So 2 points. One is I'm only middle-aged if I live to be 112. One. But two, I do want to say that authenticity is a great word, but I think that there also, I believe, is a trust that you have as a very accomplished writer. That we in telling the story and telling the story in the way that you do it, that we have the tools in our toolbox to understand the story, that we are going to be able to put these pieces together and to understand that. And if there is a word, if there is something that we don't immediately grasp, we either will, or it will help inform us later.
Yes. It is partly trust. It is partly craft. You have to keep working at it. You know, I accept that as a challenge, you know, and I hope in my late middle age, now that I am there too, in the next few years, I just want to get better at it. There's trust. Yes, yes. I really think that we are all imaginative beings who inhabit this vast universe, and cultures are porous. Our influences cross borders all the time. Just like the shirts and the pants that we wear also cross borders, you know. Everything is transnational now. And our stories are too. And so I have complete trust. But I do think there is a way in which you can make it better. And that sort of transparency, or at least, or sometimes resistance, is something I want to work at over the next few years. And maybe I'll present you with a better book soon.
It's hard to believe that it could be better, but I will ask that in the previous novel, and I will ask you if you agree with the assertion, and then we'll discuss it, which is the previous novel seemed to me much more overt in your horror and concern about our state of the world.
Yes.
This book includes that, but it is muted and it is much more toward the end, and it is almost sort of showing us the culmination, not culmination, but the what can happen if this continues in the way that you had described in the previous novel.
Wonderful. Yes, I agree entirely. I was reporting on the world of fake news in my previous novel, and I was asking myself very urgently the question, what is the role of fiction in the age of the fiction called fake news? And I thought that the way to counter it was in some ways by asserting on facts. And therefore, there was a very overt, as you said, attempt to state a certain politics and a certain series of histories or incidents. In this one, I thought, let the stories of the characters and their experiences tell that story. Let me put my faith in fiction. And that's what I've done here. So I agree with you.
We'll end with this, but what does
Yes.
faith in fiction mean to you?
It means that one does not insist necessarily on being, baldly presenting the facts, instead engaging and dwelling in contradictions, in wanting, and also in being fond of everyone in the novel, finding humanity everywhere, rather than dividing the world into those who are on the right side and the wrong side. And because that's what, in other words, faith in fiction is also means fealty or fidelity to life. It's messiness and
And
it's beauty.
that's what was so special, and yes, beauty of that section you were mentioning about the doctor. There is a dwelling. There's a dwelling
Yes.
that you have as a writer, and for us as a reader to dwell on that moment, this chance meeting that proves to be
Yes.
important.
Yes. Joe, like that doctor, you and I should also have a jalapeno margarita sometime soon.
I look forward to that, very
All
much
right.
so. I look
Thank
forward to it.
you
The
so much.
name of the new novel is My Beloved Life. It is published by Knopf. Amitabh, it's always a great pleasure and honor to speak to you. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the novel. I can't tell you how much I enjoy our conversations, and I look forward to seeing and drinking with you soon.
Lovely. Thank you so much. It's an honor for me too, and a pleasure.
Again, Amitabh Kumar's new novel is My Beloved Life. It is published by Knopf. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org. Also on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.